Today I'm going to talk about Mara, an idea some of you are probably familiar with. Mara is effectively the Buddhist equivalent of Satan, the devil. And one might wonder, having just talked about the path yesterday and how one enters a path, what possible relevance does it have to now start talking about the devil? In fact, though, and again, not only in Buddhism, but in the monotheistic traditions too, the devil is understood very much as that which blocks our path. The Greek word that is often used in the Christian Bible, or the New Testament, so-called, translates the term as diabolos in Greek, which literally means that which is thrown across the path. And in Hebrew too, I believe, the word Satan means the one who opposes you, the adversary, the one who gets in the way, as it were. We find, for example, in the book of Job, that Job complains that the devil has fenced up my way that I cannot pass, and he has set darkness in my path. So the link between the demonic and the path is a very crucial one. The devil is what prevents one from proceeding unimpeded along the path, in this case, the Eightfold Path. I mentioned, I think, yesterday, how Buddhism speaks very often of hindrances. And hindrances really are those things that block us, that stop us. Classically, the five hindrances are spoken of as attachments, aversions, lethargy, restlessness, and doubt. And again, when we sit in meditation, and we seek to still the mind, we seek to make the mind more clear and bright and attentive so that we can investigate, look deeply into things. No matter how strong our motivation might be to do this, we constantly find something else breaking in to our experience that somehow stops that process from happening. This can be very frustrating. We may have had experiences in meditation over the years that have been profoundly insightful, liberating, joyous. We have no doubts anymore about the value and the possibilities of such a practice. And yet, it's as though there's something inside us somewhere that is rebelling, resisting that very movement forward, that movement into what we do not know, that movement beyond the limits that seem to confine us, something that blocks that longing for transcendence, that longing to go beyond. Mara is, I think, a very powerful way of describing how we, as it were, obstruct ourselves. Not volitionally, we don't want to do it, but it happens. The word Mara literally means, in Sanskrit, in Pali, it means the killer. It's connected to the Sanskrit word Mrityu, death. It's the one who kills. And in this way, Mara is literally understood as death itself, as Yama. Yama being the classical Indian god of death, the one who kills. And of course, our path most effectively is blocked by dropping dead. If we die, that's, as far as we know, the end of it. But there are any number of ways in which, although we still remain alive, healthy and vital, nonetheless, we feel inside ourselves a kind of inner death. Mara is a way of talking about how we can be dead even though we are alive. That spiritually we can feel stuck, frustrated, blocked. And in fact, the very idea of Mara is implicit in the idea of samsara. Samsara is an idea we find in all Indian traditions. And it literally means the cycle of birth and death, classically, this endless process of dying, being reborn, dying, being reborn, in different places, in different realms, but always the same repetitive and rather pointless cycle, just going round and round and round and round and round. The Buddha, as well as the whole Upanishadic tradition, sees liberation as a breaking free of this cycle of repetition. Now, if we don't accept literally the idea of rebirth, nonetheless, the notion of samsara is a very powerful metaphor for a deep psychological condition that we frequently find ourselves in. In other words, how we so easily get caught in repetitive habits of thought and behavior. And there's nothing, I think, in this world that is exempt from becoming a habit. Meditation can become a habit. It can be something we just go through the motions of 20 minutes twice a day. And rather than being liberating, sometimes it almost feels as if it's a kind of stagnation, a kind of routine, but something that has lost touch with that vital spark of life that animated it, perhaps for many years, and then suddenly we recognize that we're just going round in circles, albeit spiritual circles. And I think as long as we're alive, as long as we're in this body, we are subject to this inertia of substituting, very subtly sometimes, what was once a path which led into an unknown that opened up possibilities that we have not yet realized. And instead we find ourselves all of a sudden and perhaps unawares back into a circle. We're going round and round and round again and not, as it were, getting anywhere. And that is Mara. In German you have this expression, ein Teufelskreis. In English would say a vicious circle, which in German literally means a devil's circle, ein Teufelskreis. There's something demonic, something diabolic about these patterns of habit that we get locked into. And that is a kind of death. It's not really life anymore, but it's a kind of living death. And we feel that. We feel that in the body. We feel that emotionally. It might even bring us down into a kind of depression. Depression, I think, in many ways, is the kind of the contemporary pathology of the diabolic, or boredom. If you have read Baudelaire's wonderful sequence of poems, Les Fleurs du Mal, The Flowers of Evil, it opens with this beautiful evocation of the demonic as l'ennui, boredom. This, I feel, is very much how we experience the demonic in a secular setting. This state of torpor and lethargy and disinterest. Perhaps this is moha. This feeling neither good, neither bad, neither pleasant, neither agreeable, just a kind of disinterested fog. It is speaking metaphorically about the effects of Mara, or of Satan, or the devil. But Mara is not the only word the Buddha uses to describe this. Several synonyms we find in the Pali for Mara, one of which is Kanha, which in Sanskrit is Krishna, and it means the dark one. Sometimes Mara is called that. But more interestingly, Mara is called by the Buddha Namuchi. In the Sutta Nipata, in the Padana Sutta, which is translated as the Great Striving, it's a very early Pali text that talks about the Buddha's renunciation and his struggle for enlightenment. It says that he's sitting on the bank of the Nerindara River near Bodh Gaya, and then it says Namuchi came up to him. Namuchi. Who the hell is Namuchi? I'd never heard of Namuchi before. Namuchi turns out to be a demon from the early Vedic tradition who is the one who prevents the monsoon, the rains, from falling. And Namuchi, the word literally means the one who withholds the water, the one who withholds the water, withholds the rain. And it takes Indra, who's the king of the gods in Indian mythology, to throw his vajra, his scepter, at Namuchi. And when it hits Namuchi, Namuchi goes, ah! And the monsoon comes rushing forth. Now, I think this is a very telling image. What greater image is there for life than water? Water that is falling from the sky, freely given, that enables the harvest in the end to be reaped, for the soil to be fertile, and for people to flourish, for animals to flourish. And I think it's very curious that the early Buddhist tradition chose this image to depict its understanding of the demonic. In other words, Mara is that which prevents life. Mara is that which prevents us from living to the full. And in this respect, if we see Buddha and Mara as kind of counterpoints, then to the extent to which Mara stands for death, both literally and figuratively, so Buddha is a way of talking about life, about living to the full. And if we consider the practice in this regard, we can see too how what we spoke of yesterday about looking deeply into suffering, knowing it fully, unflinchingly, without fear, to such an extent that we begin to transform our sense of what this world is. We acknowledge it as transient, as unfulfilling in some way of our desires. And in letting go of such attachments, of such cravings, we bring something to a stop. Now, what we bring to a stop is effectively the grasping of Mara. Mara is, in the Buddha Nikaya, for example, equated with grasping itself. The Buddha says, whenever a person grasps, Mara stands beside them. So in some ways, what prevents us from being alive is this clinging, is this craving, is this grasping. And perhaps at the core of that lies this instinctive spasm, almost, of which we, that we call me. In Sanskrit, this is atmagraha, self-clinging. And that, in Buddhist psychology, is what lies at the root of all the other kilesa, all of the other negative mind states, that likewise are modalities of clinging, whether it's attachment or whether it's hatred, they're both forms of tanha, of craving, of grasping. And that is Mara, this tightening up, this locking ourselves into a fixated image of me as some kind of permanent thing. And again, we'll come back to this, it's not just the mind that does this. The body does this. The biology does this. It's interesting to note that when the Buddha speaks of the five skandhas, the five aggregates, as usually translated, he often refers to them as the panchupadana kanda, the five aggregates of upadana. And upadana too means clinging. It's as though our whole organism is to some extent invested into holding on tight. And again, we experience this, for example, when in a moment of physical danger, we contract, we run away instinctively. We don't have to think, oh gosh, now wait a minute, that's a big truck coming towards me. What do I do now? Well, let's see. No, we just instinctively, before we even think, we react. We were working once in California, near Spirit Rock, up in the Fairfax Hill. And Martine was by my side. And suddenly, Martine did something that she doesn't normally do, something equivalent to a kind of long jump, as though she were doing training for some Olympic event. And it was only when she landed that we looked back and she had jumped over a rattlesnake. She hadn't been conscious of the rattlesnake, but something in her self-preservation in the organism had registered rattlesnake and had taken action before either of us went, oh, what was that? And, you know, it was a rattlesnake, you know, not the sort of thing you want to tread on. So this self-preservation, this grasping, is at one level built into the actual physicality of our existence. So in that sense, you know, it has a value, clearly. But when it comes to seeking, as it were, something beyond just mere physical or material survival or satisfaction, when we want to live fully and deeply, and I guess most of us would use the word spiritually, in a way in which we realize our deepest, innermost capacities as a human being, then these kinds of instinctive contractions and fears and graspings only get in the way. And again, I'm using the word very carefully. They get in the way. They get in the path. They block that kind of longing or that kind of need to go beyond these constricting factors. So samsara is a way of talking about how we go round and round in these patterns of habit, whereas the path is that which breaks out of that cycle and leads us into what we do not know, leads us into other possibilities. And this is where Mara becomes, as it were, rather concerned. And it's almost as though sometimes when we begin to embark on a path, it's as though we're almost provoking Mara into some kind of reaction. And we find this language, this mythological language, in many different traditions. I've got a passage here somewhere from Islam, from the Quran. Yeah, here we go. This is from there's a story in the Quran where God invites Satan to honor God's new creation, which is man, the human being. And Mara, or Satan, refuses to bow before man. He says, I don't have it here, but he says something like, that he is born from mud, I am born from fire. And then Satan makes a vow in the presence of God. And he says, I will waylay your servants as they walk on your straight path, then spring upon them from the front and from the rear, from the right and from the left. It's exactly the same kind of metaphor, the straight path of Akhla, of God. And once the human being sets out on such a path, Satan has vowed to get in the way, to waylay your servants, to block their path. So we have, I think, in Mara or Satan, a very powerful mythological language. And I think the strength of the metaphor lies in its taking form in a personified person. Mara is depicted as a person, as a kind of spirit or a demon. And in many ways, I think this image is more powerful than a kind of philosophical or theological attempt to define Mara. We tend to miss something when we speak of Mara as, you know, certain mental states or something like that, certain negative states of mind. That catches a bit of it, but it reduces it to a kind of psychological analysis. Whereas the trickster figure of Mara, Satan, is one that embodies so much more than just some dry psychological analysis. And it's in the text on Mara that we get some of the richest imagery that we find in the Pali text. The Pali texts are not renowned for rich, evocative imagery. But when we get to Mara, we suddenly find ourselves in a much richer metaphorical language. Another image the Buddha uses for Mara He calls him Antaka in Pali. Antaka. Anta in Sanskrit in Pali means something like the end, or the limit, or the border, the horizon. And ka implies someone who imposes limits, imposes borders. Antaka, therefore, is a way of talking about how Mara is that which limits us. Mara is that which somehow encloses our sense of who we are within a fixed idea, a fixed concept, a fixed image, where we might feel superficially safe. We have maybe a clear ego identity, but the cost of that is very often that of somehow cutting ourselves off, cutting ourselves adrift from the matrix of life from which we have emerged. It's a limiting function. It's an enclosing function. So we can think of Mara in all manner of different ways. In traditional Buddhism, and this was the way in which I first really came across Mara, Mara is described as being of four types. In the Tibetan tradition, this is pretty much all they know of Mara, really. They call them the Dusu, the four Maras, the four demons. The first one is the Kilesa, which was looked at. Kilesa Mara, the Mara of the negative states of mind. I don't really need to say much more about that. This is, in many ways, the form of Mara that seems to us most easily intelligible. In other words, when we're grasping, when we're caught up in some neurotic fantasy or craving, necessarily we are somehow constricted. We're not living fully. We are limited in what we can do. But the Buddha also speaks of Skandamara. Skandamara implies that Mara pervades the entirety of the phenomenal world itself. Remember, the skandhas, although they're sometimes explained as a kind of description of our body and our mind, our psychophysical organism, the skandhas are actually a way of talking about sabbasankara, all conditioned things are within the skandhas, not just the body and the mind. There's something within the structure of the world itself that limits us. Now, to illustrate this, I'd like to look at a passage in the Sanyutta Nikaya, which comes under the heading "The Farmer." So the Buddha, it says, on that occasion, the Buddha was instructing the monks with a Dhamma talk concerning Nibbana. And there were bhikkhus listening to the Dharma with eager ears, attending to it as a matter of vital concern, applying their whole minds to it. And then, on the horizon, there appears a farmer, and it describes the farmer as carrying a large plough on his shoulder, holding a long goad stick for beating oxen. His hair is disheveled, wearing hempen, i.e. very cheap garments, his feet smeared with mud. The farmer approached the Buddha and said to him, "Maybe you've seen my oxen." And the Buddha replies, "What are oxen to you, Mara?" And the farmer replies, The eye is mine. Forms are mine. Eye contact and I consciousness are mine. The ear is mine. Sounds are mine. Audio consciousness is mine. The tongue is mine. The nose is mine. The body is mine. The mind is mine. Ideas, smells, thoughts, tastes, touches, they're all mine. Where can you go to escape me? He said. And this is what the Buddha replies. He says, where there is no eye, no ear, no tongue, no nose, no body, no mind, where there are no sights, no sounds, no smells, no tastes, no touches, no ideas, when there is no eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, etc., there is no place for you there, Mara. Now, Mara. I think so. Now this, of course, reminds us of the Heart Sutra, which says exactly the same thing. But this is a text that long predates the Heart Sutra. And the rest of the context is very interesting. Now clearly the Buddha's not suggesting, that, you know, when there is literally no eyes and ears and nose, in other words, when you're dead, there will be no place for you there, Mara. But he seems to be suggesting that if we can radically transform our relationship to our world, where we don't break everything up into discrete bits and pieces, eyes and ears and noses and sights and sounds and things like that, as soon as we divide the world, as soon as we break it up into discrete units, that is what establishes the basis for our being able to want to possess some things, get rid of other things, and somehow manipulate and control the world so that we can safely feel that it is mine. That's the strategy of Mara. And as long as we continue in that kind of, in those kinds of divisions and separations, which seems again not to be anything like a choice we make, it seems to be built into the very structure of perception and consciousness. It's there, it's given. But if we can begin to notice how there is, in a sense, no eye, no ear, no nose, there's nothing, these things do not exist as sort of independent things. They are simply points within the fabric of life itself. They only are what they are because of their relations and connections, their being dependently arising phenomena, emerging from a matrix of conditions, changing, becoming something else, renewing themselves, everything being connected one to the next in a seamless fashion. I spoke yesterday of how these Four Noble Truths are like an organic process. You can't break them up into bits. That's Mara at work. As soon as we start doing that, as soon as we establish these limits. Now, of course, language itself functions within that framework. Language, by giving us words, giving us a subject, and a verb, and an object, parses the world into pieces. That's both its strength, which enables us to communicate, it enables us to write poetry, but it's also its potential danger. because it gives us the illusion, or it can give us the illusion, that the world literally corresponds to subject, verb, object. That every word in our language somehow represents an equally discrete thing out there. This doesn't mean, though, that we abandon language. Then we go too far. But we begin to understand one can almost say, the diabolic potential of language. Language can free us, because after all, this text I just read is language, it's words, it's concepts. We cannot but use these things, but we need constantly to be aware of how they can also trick us in a very deep way. And so what the Buddha seems here to be pointing out is that if we can see through that diabolic structure of language and thought and concepts, and recognize that there's nothing in the world that actually corresponds to such things, such ideas, then our relationship with our experience becomes really something else. And in conclusion, he says here, I'm not one of those who speak of mine. You should know this, Mara, or you should know it this way, Mara, that even my path you will not see. Even my path you will not see. That there's something about what the Buddha has found that makes him impervious to Mara. And this, I think, is a very crucial point. Many Buddhist traditions, probably all of them, or most of them anyway, you have the idea that the Buddha has become the Buddha, the awakened one, or the enlightened one, through having destroyed Mara, through having eliminated Mara. He's become perfect. He no longer has the slightest flicker of attachment or fear or hatred. And in the Mahayana tradition, the Buddha does not even have thoughts anymore. The Buddha doesn't have concepts. He's continuously in a non-conceptual state of mind, acting purely spontaneously out of love and wisdom and compassion, which is a beautiful ideal, but it's also somehow strangely inhuman. The Buddha has become effectively elevated to the status of God. And we have this famous image of the conquest of Mara, the overcoming of Mara. You've almost certainly seen it, where the Buddha is seated on a throne. And this occurs right before the Enlightenment. And his hand is touching the earth, and surrounding him is a halo of demonic creatures. And they're throwing rocks at him, and they're firing arrows, and they're making horrible faces. And the Buddha's sitting there just totally cool, completely at ease, with a slight smile on his face, unaffected by any of this. And he's calling the earth as his witness. Sometimes this mudra, this gesture, is called the Mara Vijaya Mudra, the gesture of overcoming Mara. He's earthed, as it were. He's totally grounded in his experience. And he's unaffected. But the problem with this idea is that it suggests that at this moment the Buddha literally overcomes Mara, and Mara is just not there anymore. And that is what allows him to be the awakened one, the Buddha. But what is curious is that in all of the dialogues, and there are many of them, that occur throughout the Pali Canon, almost every single one takes place after the Enlightenment. So the Buddha is someone who's overcome Mara, and yet Mara is still very much around. The story I gave about the farmer. The farmer is appearing to the Buddha after the Enlightenment. He's giving a talk about Nibbana, and yet Mara still appears. Now, how are we to understand? In traditional Buddhist societies, it wasn't so much of a problem. Mara was understood as a kind of god. In fact, Mara is, in Buddhist cosmology, is called a Karma Deva, the lord of desire, of karma, of sensual desire. And he's the god who controls the sensory world, the Karma Dhatu. And so when Mara appears to the Buddha, what's happening is that Karma Deva is popping down to earth, dressing up like a farmer in this case, coming up to the Buddha and saying, "Did you see my oxen?" And then the Buddha does this thing about no eyes, no ears, no da 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 da. And then it says, and then Mara disappeared right there and then. So Karma Deva says, "Ah, right," and goes back up to heaven. And then two comes down again. Now, I don't accept any of this literally. It seems to me this is a mythological language, which I think is extraordinarily important to preserve. It would be a great loss if we tried to reduce all of this to sort of an analytical, psychological language. There's a power in this language, but we have to acknowledge it as a mythic discourse. In other words, it's a way of talking about what is going on in the Buddha's experience. It's a metaphoric way of describing the Buddha's inner life. So when Mara comes up to the Buddha and starts saying, "Oh, you're very lazy, you don't seem to want to do anything, why are you lying down, do you have to sleep?" There's lots of passages like that. This is, in a way, a depiction of that little voice in the Buddha's mind that is still alive, that is still nagging at him, tempting him. And many Buddhists would find this rather problematic for someone who's supposed to be perfect. Why should this happen? Well, I think the reason it happens is because the Buddha is still embodied. The Buddha is a person in this world who sees and hears and smells and tastes and touches, who has an organism, who has to eat food, who goes to the toilet, who has a brain like everybody else's, who has a nervous system like everybody else's. He's in the world of Mara. Now, there's a passage again in the Sutta Nipata that offers us a very different notion of what it means to overcome Mara. But again, it's at the very end of the Padma Sutta, if you want to look it up. So this is how the story goes. The Buddha's, doing this Buddha thing, and then Mara comes up to him and tries to somehow distract him and so forth and so on. And then, of course, as all these stories say, the Buddha sees through Mara. He says, "I know you, Mara." And then Mara sort of slinks away. And on this occasion, you have the text continue with Mara's own thoughts. And this is Mara speaking. He says, "I remember once seeing a crow hovering above a lump of fat on the ground. Food, it thought, but the lump turned out to be a rock, hard and inedible. The crow flew away in disgust. I too have had enough," says Mara. "I'm like that crow pecking at a rock. I'm finished with Gautama. There's nothing more I can do." Now here we have not an image of Mara being kind of deleted or destroyed, but rather an image in which Mara is no longer able to have any impact or effect on the Buddha. In other words, Mara still happens, the crow still appears, but the crow has nowhere to land. The crow can't get any sustenance or nourishment out of the Buddha. There's nothing in the Buddha's mind where the crow can somehow get some purchase, can get a foothold. Now this, I think, is in many ways not just some description of the Buddha, but very much a metaphor for our own practice of meditation. We can sit with awareness of the body, of the breath, or whatever we're contemplating, and there are moments when a thought arises, a strong emotion comes up, a memory, a fantasy, whatever it might be. These things surface. And we have that moment where we either go with them, or we simply notice them for what they are. We see them as just transient, impermanent fluctuations of the mind. And if we just notice them like that, in time they'll just follow their nature and disappear. They'll come and they'll go. And we're able to be with such things without being of them, without being controlled by them. And it's that frame of mind that is symbolized by the figure of the Buddha. That is the Buddha mind, if you wish. And it's not something that only belongs to these rare and special enlightened people, but it's a possibility that is present in each moment for each of us here and now. We can be like a Buddha, or we can let Mara run the show. It's up to us. We have that choice. Now, there are two quite conflicting metaphors of freedom in the Pali Canon. You have one, which is the most common one, I have to admit this, where it says again and again, when somebody becomes an arhant, or a sort of liberated saint, then it says that the asavas, the defilements, are cut off like a palm stump, like a palm tree. You cut it off, cut it down, and it will never arise again. That's the dominant metaphor. For me, that's a violent metaphor. It's equivalent to somehow suggesting that to become enlightened, we have to have a sort of lobotomy. We have to cut off a bit of ourselves. And particularly, if, as I have, I no longer think of the of some kind of spiritual entity inhabiting the body, carrying with it certain negative states of mind, but rather understanding the human condition as something that is the product of evolution, of natural selection, that greed and hatred and delusion do not reside in some spiritual space that we can sort of tinker with in meditation, but are actually built into our neurobiology, then this kind of metaphor makes a lot more sense. That the idea of eliminating these things would imply, from this perspective, actually destroying part of our brain. And I don't think meditation could do that anyway, I hope. But what it points to is another model of freedom. A freedom in which we are fully present and aware with whatever happens, but we're no longer subject to its power or its control. So we can experience these things without feeling we've somehow failed, without feeling we're thereby deluded, but simply because this is how life works. Now there are many images, this is another one from the the Mahajana Nikaya. The Buddha describes himself as one who has blindfolded Maya, put a blindfold across his eyes, that he has become invisible to the devil. This is not an image of having destroyed Maya, but somehow having found a way of being in which Maya can no longer see you. There's nothing solid or fixed that Maya can latch onto. You've become somehow transparent or empty, as the Buddhist text would say. There's no longer any hard edge, hard corner that Maya can attach to. And that, I feel, is a much more useful image than this idea that we have to destroy something. There's a beautiful metaphor also in the Mahajana somewhere, where Maya compares himself to a crab whose legs have been torn off by children. It is a very powerful image. A crab, you know, a crab is, whose legs have been torn off by children. And Maya says, all these distortions, maneuvers, and contortions of mine have been broken and smashed to bits by you. So in other words, Maya is still around, but his power has been taken from him. It's a very different image. And so what this points to is that Maya is always part of life, and also Buddha is always part of life. That in some very crucial way, the two are inseparable. You cannot have one without the other. To split Maya into two is to fall again into Maya's strategy of duality. The Buddha and Maya. Unfortunately, when Maya is depicted figuratively as a kind of person, and the Buddha is another kind of person, you have the beginnings of dualism. The Buddha is good, the Maya is bad. But if we think of these stories symbolically and mythologically, we can understand them as talking about what happens within a single organism. In Zen, this, I think, a very good understanding of this. There's a quote by Huineng, who is the sixth Chinese patriarch of Zen, who says, when an ordinary person becomes awakened, we call them a Buddha. When an ordinary person becomes awakened, we call them a Buddha. When a Buddha becomes deluded, we call them an ordinary person. So in other words, Buddha and Maya are really just two different modalities of a single organism. It's a bit like, you know, those gestalt images. You can look at a picture and it can be two faces looking at each other. Or with a sudden perceptual switch, it becomes a vase. Now there's only one thing there, not two, but we can configure it in two different ways. And it's the same with this organism. It can configure as Buddha, or it can configure as Maya. Another image that I find helpful here is the image of a valve, you know, like on the tire of a car or a bicycle. A valve is a single thing, but a valve can be open or a valve can be closed. Right? And in the same way, the human organism can be open or it can be closed. It's not two things going on, but it's the same single thing in different modalities. The closed or the open. One of the most beautiful images of this is in this rather famous passage by William Blake, the English poet. This is in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, which again is a very powerful reflection on the devil, actually. And Blake says, if the doors of perception were cleansed, every sin would appear to man as it is, infinite. For man has closed himself up till he sees all things through the narrow chinks or gaps of his cave, his cavern. If the doors of perception were cleansed, in the 60s, we all knew the first half of this. This slogan, of this. I never heard the latter part. Now, if you take LSD, then the doors of perception, wow. You know. You fail to notice when you come down off LSD, everything gets closed down again. We won't think about that. But this metaphor, I think, is very close to what I'm trying to say. If the doors of perception were cleansed, this is a beautiful image for what we do in meditation, effectively. If we cleanse the doors of perception. As we do that, then everything would appear to man as it is, infinite, without infinite, without finite, without limits, without anta. So? Cleansed, cleaned, yeah, cleaned, polished, sort of swept, washed. But the problem is, man has closed himself up till he sees all things through narrow chinks of his cavern. And I think human life, in many ways, constantly oscillates between these two possibilities. Chinks of cavern is like, imagine you're in a very dark place, like a cave, and you just, there's one or two places where you can see outside. So in other words, your vision of the world is very restricted. You just see a bit of it. Whereas, and that's Mara's perspective. Everything's also broken up into bits. The Buddha perspective is to open up like that. So I think I'll leave it there. We could go on and on and on. I mean, I've written a whole book about this. If you're interested in reading more. But we can explore again more of this afternoon. Thank you very much.